marketing program. So, Mark, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Bob. I want to challenge you to think about genetic defects and how we manage genetic defects in, from a little different paradigm than what I think you're probably accustomed to thinking about them through. And so we'll just look at things a little bit differently. As Bob said, recessive defects have gained a lot of attention in recent years. DNA tests have been developed and have been quite effective in reducing their frequencies to inconsequential levels. This is a powerful new tool. But the only way to prevent new recessive defects from becoming problems within various breeds is to discover them before they reach high frequencies. And the most practical way to do that seems to be through inbreeding. But most of us as breeders try to avoid close inbreeding so that we don't see the recessive defects. And as long as we hide them, we're not going to know where they are, and they can creep up to higher frequencies before we do find them, and then all of a sudden we have a train wreck. So the first thing that we need to address when we suspect that we might have a new genetic defect is to question, is it really genetic or not? Often this isn't clear. There's a lot of environmental things that could cause calves to have abnormalities, and so we don't know for sure whether it's genetic. If we decide that it might be genetic, then we need to think about, is it recessive or is it dominant, result of epistasis? And inbreeding really is going to be the most effective way to determine that mode of inheritance as well, although we can do it without inbreeding. If we determine, I'm going to focus only on recessive genetic defects for the remainder of the talk. If we determine that it is a recessive defect, then we want to get a DNA test developed for it, and the obvious question is, where is it located in the genome? Once we've determined that, then it's relatively straightforward to develop markers to track the defect through multiple generations and select against the defect, eliminate it from our populations, or at least reduce the frequency to the extent that it's manageable. So I've talked a little bit about inbreeding. Inbreeding has been tremendously powerful as a tool in plant breeding. But in animal breeding, the early pioneers, Jay Lush, Gordon Dickerson, and others, recognized a number of theoretical advantages to inbreeding. And there were a large number of experiments on inbreeding conducted from the 1930s through the 1950s and 60s. But the general conclusion was that the challenges were just too great to make inbreeding practical in livestock, and it's really been used a lot less in recent years than it was 50 years ago. The problem is, when people try to develop lines of inbred cattle, various problems would be recessive defects of various types would increase in frequency somewhat gradually, but would really reduce the productivity and viability of those lines. And the only way they had to eliminate those defects at that time was through progeny testing. It's so slow, you couldn't eliminate the defects as fast as they might accrue. So it really wasn't practical with the tools that were available at that point in time. But with the DNA tools that we have today, I think that we really need to reevaluate the feasibility of inbreeding in cattle. So what I want to do this afternoon is to propose a strategy that could make it practical to systematically identify, map, and select against recessive alleles. We want to consider some of the challenges in implementing this strategy and how we might overcome those, explore some potential secondary benefits of the strategy, and discuss some general principles in managing genetic defects in breeding programs. So our current approach to reducing genetic defects is what I refer to as just putting out fires. We wait until we have a crisis, and then all of a sudden we need to get a DNA test developed as fast as possible. It can never be fast enough, and then everybody goes about trying to get rid of those animals that are detected as being carriers just as soon as possible. That involves trying to find either the cause of mutations or polymorphisms that are in very close linkage disequilibrium with those, and then we start using DNA testing, particularly in the major sires in the breed, to get rid of those defects. Strategy that I want to discuss this afternoon is that breeders who have young sires that they think could become influential in a breed would initially progeny test those bulls and produce enough daughters to get to about 25 to 50 progeny, so that they would have enough daughters that they could breed the sire back to those daughters. And our goal probably ought to be to produce around 16 to 32 progeny of sire-daughter matings. These inbred progeny is what I'll refer to them as. From sire-daughter matings, we'd expect an average of an eighth of the progeny to be affected for any genetic defect that sire carried. So we'd be looking at producing an average, depending on how many inbred progeny we want to make, somewhere around 2 to 4 affected progeny. Then, assuming if we did get at least 2 affected progeny, then we would attempt to map those defects using both the affected progeny and the unaffected progeny. The affected progeny provide a lot more mapping information, but we have a lot more unaffected calves, and they provide information with which to map these defects as well. And then we would commence to select against those genomic regions that are most likely to contain these defects, and that would be in the descendants of the sires that we tested. So if we're going to make this happen, we've got to give breeders an incentive to do it. I mean, if we don't have some sort of a general system, then it's just kind of a good citizen thing to do. I'm going to put my bull at risk just so I can help the breed out. So I think that we've got to have some sort of a system of incentives to make it profitable for people to go through this process. And so for this presentation, I'm going to designate sires that are going through this process with a gold star. And I think we need to come up with some sort of a designation and a logo that could be used in promotional material so that the people that bear the expense to do it get credit for having done it, and that it actually adds value to the bull instead of detracting from the value of the bull. So my proposal would be this should be done at the time that the bull's enrolled in the program. This is not a gold star that says this bull is free of genetic defects. It's a gold star that says he's going through this process, and if he has genetic defects, we're going to be able to map them. That's really what's important. It's not that we're just trying to find bulls that are completely free of genetic defects. I don't think we know how many bulls there are going to be that will be free of genetic defects. And it depends on how we define a genetic defect. I'm going to go through that in a little bit more detail later. But if we use a pretty broad definition, there may not be all that many bulls that are truly free of genetic defects. I don't think we really know. But the idea is we give the breeder credit for going through the process, and so it really reduces then the risk of putting a bull into the process. And that's what we need in order to make this happen on a broad enough scale for it to have an impact. So I'm going to discuss one very specific way to implement this general idea. I'm just going to say that there are a whole multitude of variations on this that we could consider. A lot of them might fit better in specific circumstances, but the point of the presentation is not to explore all the different variations that we could go through. I just want to get the general concept across and see whether people are interested in it or have no interest in it. So a tool that'll be really valuable and it really makes the difference, makes it possible to explore this approach that we really didn't have even 2 or 3 years ago, is the 50K chip. You've heard about it all day long. I'm not going to dwell on it, but it's a really powerful tool that should really make it a lot more efficient to map these genetic defects once we've identified that they occur. But really, I think to make it work effectively, I think we need some additional tools that aren't really in the standard toolkit today, but could be relatively easily. In other words, the technology's there to do what we need to do. We just don't have, to my knowledge, commercial testing products out there that would allow us to go through this full spectrum. And so, for example, I mentioned we really want to tap into those unaffected progeny to improve mapping efficiency, but it may not be cost-effective to run the 50K chip across all the animals. We might want to run the 50K chip across the affected progeny, and then some other lower-density SNP set that spans the whole genome across the unaffecteds, and that should come at a lower price per animal. And then somewhere along the way in the process, we probably need some customization so that for each different defect that occurs in a different family, we probably need some customized testing products. And then there's probably ways to consolidate those into perhaps breed-specific products. A lot of different opportunities in terms of how that would happen, but it probably means we need to look at a little different way of going about DNA testing for these things than what is commonly done today. So we need a new class of DNA testing services. Obviously, there'd be some investment required to make that happen. Breeders, before they made the commitment to do sire-daughter matings, would probably like to have some assurances that somebody's going to be offering a service that would allow them to map those things if they find them. On the other hand, DNA testing companies need some assurance that there's going to be some customers for that service if they invest in producing it. So there needs to be some communication back and forth. It's not something that one entity ought to just jump out and make a big investment in without having some collaborations or partners established on the other side of the process. How well could we map these defects? Generally, 2 to 4 affected progeny from a set of 16 sire-daughter matings are going to provide sufficient information to map a recessive defect reasonably well. This is based on some assumptions, and that is, one is that the unaffected SIBs are available for DNA analysis and that we use those unaffected SIBs and can afford to run the DNA test on them. The other is that the phenotypes are unambiguous. In other words, if we have a defect that's a lethal curly calf or something like this, it's pretty clear that the calf is affected or unaffected. There's not a lot of ambiguity, is it or is it not? If we get into the ambiguity, it's going to decrease the mapping efficiency considerably. But if we make those assumptions, if we made sire-daughter mating, if we got 16 progeny, and 2 of those were affected, and I'm going to indicate those as these bright yellow animals. We ought to, on average, map this defect to 3 different regions of the genome, and they'd be fairly small regions, and in total, they'd probably represent about 1% of the genome. Now, obviously, there's going to be variation. In some cases, we might map it to 1, and in some cases, it might be 6 different regions. And if it's 6, it's going to be hard to manage. We're going to want to improve that mapping resolution. There's options for how we would go about doing that. If we get 3 affected progeny, then on average we're going to see about 1.6 chromosomal regions. So we got a lot better chance with 3 progeny of getting it down to just 1 region. But there's still a good chance of having multiple regions as well. And the average size of the region that we're going to find it in will go down a little bit. And at this point, we'd expect to have it located to about 0.5% of the genome. If we got 4 affected progeny, then we have a really good chance at that point of getting it down to just one region of the genome, and it's probably going to be less than 10 centimorgans or less than a third of a percent of the genome. So at about 4 progeny, we have a really good chance of being able to follow this thing pretty effectively. And I'm illustrating here four progeny that came out of a family of 16. If we had four progeny that came out of a family of 32, it only gets better. So obviously the more progeny, the better the mapping efficiency, but also the greater the potential cost to the breeder, and so we have to weigh the costs and benefits. The selection strategy is, in order to make something like this work, we just have to change our paradigm about recessive defects, and we don't cull tested sires that have defects. Unless they were borderline, to be culled anyway, and then sure enough we go ahead and cull them. But we don't cull just based on a recessive defect, and we don't ever select just based on a recessive defect. That really imposes a high cost on the industry. So the selection occurs in the descendants of the tested sires, and it occurs before we make an investment to progeny test those descendants. So I think that we really have a lot less risk of economic loss to the breeder due to these recessive defects. We can kind of know how to plan for it and incorporate it into a breeding program. That selection may also occur in collateral relatives of the sires in which the defects were originally identified and mapped. In other words, if you put a young bull through the progeny testing scheme and he has a defect, you'll be able to determine whether that bull's sire and grandsires had that defect and whether their descendants are carrying that defect or not. And it needs to be implemented in such a way that it doesn't really affect generation intervals substantially. And I think we can do that. That's not a real problem to work into the system. So I mentioned before we can define defects in several different ways. I think when most of us think of genetic defects, we think of these really severe abnormalities, a lot of times lethals. They're things that we think, we just have to get rid of this. We can't afford to put up with it. But I want to propose to you that what may be more common is what I'm going to refer to as subclinical recessive defects that just reduce production and or cause nonconformities in our production system. But more than likely, we would not currently recognize these as recessive genetic defects. And I'm going to propose that I think there may be a lot of these out in the industry that we just don't recognize because our mating systems are not set up for us to find these and recognize them. So I think that a breeding program like this takes real strong advantage of cutting-edge DNA technology, but I think it also maybe takes us back in time a little bit, a few years, to where the art of cattle breeding had a lot to do with the eye of a skilled breeder. And really visually inspecting cattle very carefully and taking advantage of the powers of observation and the people who have a real knack for remembering animals that were two or three generations back in the pedigrees and been dead for 10 years. And what happened in those animals. And I would suspect that most of you who breed cattle have seen things show up in your herd time after time that you say, I wish I could get rid of these calves that look like this. There's some aspect to them that just isn't quite right. And every one of your herds probably has something different. It's not that this is occurring. Some of them may be widespread across an entire breed, but a lot of them will be very specific to a particular family or a particular herd. So if we do this, you're going to need to start looking within these small sets of inbred progeny for just various anomalies, structural unsoundnesses, causes of unthriftiness, cattle that just don't grow well, and look at them and see, does it really look like this is coming from a common physiological basis? And if it's occurring at about the rate that you would expect, about an eighth of the inbred progeny, then there might be a pretty good chance that it's due to a recessive defect. And it might be worth trying to map that and just select that out of your herd. And that might improve the average performance of your herd and reduce the variability in phenotype. So doing this would be a lot easier if all of the progeny inbred to a particular sire are contemporaries in time, location, and management. Now that's probably not always going to be possible. But if you could take all of those cattle and put them in a pen together and go through and look at all those animals, I'll bet we would all be surprised at what we would see. I think it would be a really interesting thing to do. I'm going to just try to give you an example of what could happen. These are not the result of sire-daughter matings. They're not all the same breed composition. But this is just a set of calves that we had recently. And our cattle operations crew thought that we had a genetic defect segregating out here. I really question whether this is a recessive defect because of the pedigree structure and breed composition of this group of calves. But do you see the ones in there that our crew was concerned about? They're calves that just are a little bit smaller for their age. That's hard to tell here. They're a little bit shorter and more compact. The first one that we had was had some structural deformities, and they tend to be a little bit more muscular, or just a little bit more compact. I just throw this out to just try to make you think. What is there that's segregating out there that we'd rather not have, that we don't call a recessive defect today? But if we could eliminate those things from our herds, what would the impact be on the performance and consistency of the beef industry? Could we eliminate some of the real dinks that get to the feed yard and don't grow and really don't fit into our normal production system? So in many cases, it's not going to be possible, if we broaden our definition of genetic defects, to determine unambiguously whether a particular anomaly is a recessive defect or not. But if it occurs repeatedly and other closely related sires, combining those families together may make it pretty clear whether or not that anomaly is due to a recessive defect. And it also should provide sufficient information with which to map that defect relatively unambiguously. So, as I said, the efficiency is a lot lower per animal if it's not clearly distinguishable, but I don't think it's necessarily impractical to do. It just means that if we're going to take this approach, we need to kind of do it on a big scale. It's not something we want to just kind of tinker around with. We want to either really do it, or it's probably not worth doing. So this is to illustrate what we could do with multiple generations. If we put a bull through the system and we get one affected calf, even if it's extremely clear that we have only one affected calf, about 25% of the genome is going to be not excluded from carrying that defect or possibly carrying it. So we really can't do anything more with just that one calf. But if we take another son of this bull, we put him through the system, and let's say he produces two affected progeny, and it mapped the defect to three regions, well, you say, well, we still don't really have enough information. But if we combine that information, the intersection of these regions and this region is just one region. And with those three progeny, three affecteds, 32 unaffecteds, and the fact that they're in different families gives us some additional mapping power, we really have a good shot at getting that thing mapped to just one region. And if we get it mapped to just one region, it's going to be a lot more effective to apply selection to get rid of it than if we have it mapped to multiple regions. Although it's not completely infeasible to apply selection to multiple regions. So I want to visit just briefly about what would we do about recessive defects that cause embryonic mortality. These would be things that occur that just stop the process of development sometime early in pregnancy. And we know that a lot of embryos fail to develop sometime prior to probably day 15 or so. It may be that recessive lethal defects are one of the primary causes of infertility in cattle. And if we could develop a system that would allow us to identify embryonic lethals and breed them out of the population, that may be our best opportunity for improving the genetics of fertility in the beef industry. I don't think we know whether that's the case or not, but it may be our best opportunity. It seems plausible that they're an important cause. I doubt that we have just, you know, a handful of embryonic lethal defects that we're going to do a research project on and discover and set up a standardized DNA test that everybody runs across the whole beef industry and increase reproductive rate this way. But if we went through a system where we put sires through this progeny testing system and we did it in such a way that we had a chance at identifying these embryonic lethals and then applying selection to them, I think there's at least a chance that we could improve reproductive performance in a significant way. And as you all know, it doesn't take a real big improvement in reproductive performance in the beef industry to have pretty sizable economic effect. It is much more challenging to identify and map these embryonic mortality lethals, and the problem is that we don't get to DNA test the affecteds. And so in most of the systems we'd be looking at, we have to map them from the unaffecteds, and it takes a lot more of those unaffecteds. And so we probably would have to do it by combining a number of relatively closely related bulls that have been through this system. That's, again, like I'm going to come back repeatedly to, that this approach has a lot more benefits if we do it on a big scale than it does if just every once in a while somebody puts the most prominent bull in the Angus breed through this system. The benefits come with doing it repeatedly, generation after generation. However, if these inbreds were produced through embryo transfer, that opens up some other additional opportunities, particularly if we had lethals that were expressed that stopped embryonic development or slowed it down enough that it was visible by day 7 when we're doing the transfers. If we could pull out those embryos that weren't developing normally and they could become a DNA source, that could be fairly powerful. Okay. Now, if we stretch our imagination a little bit further and just really get optimistic, I think there's some even more exciting opportunities out of doing this. And that is, we have all these inbred progeny that we're producing, and we certainly don't want to recommend that all of the progeny of anyone's sire are going to be out of his daughters. You're going to have outbred progeny by these same sires. And so we could fit a sire-specific inbreeding depression in our national cattle evaluation system. And by fitting that effect, then that would help us to identify on a quantitative basis which bulls are most likely to have these defects. It probably are what I'd call subclinical, or maybe even less obvious than the subclinical ones, which ones would be most important to run through the system. But also it would give us kind of almost an EPD for inbreeding depression, and we could apply selection directly to that. So it really opens up a lot of additional opportunities, I think. This would be based on a comparison of the performance within contemporary groups of the inbred versus non-inbred progeny of a bull. So I think we have, the way the system's set up, reasonable power for doing it if we set the mating system up right. But again, in order to make it productive for National Cattle Evaluation Service providers to develop the methodology and the programming and set up the system and run it all, you know, this has to be done on a big scale or this isn't going to happen. And then the real selection that would come out of this is made a lot more practical by the availability of the DNA testing to be applied to the system. So this sire-specific inbreeding depression would be based on, and really most of the concepts I'm trying to propose today are going to be based on the concept that being right more often than you're wrong in the face of uncertainty generates a lot more progress in breeding than only selecting when you're certain that you're right. And, you know, several years ago, the idea was that DNA testing was going to take all the uncertainty out of cattle breeding. And, you know, we're just going to know exactly what the genetic merit is of every animal, and it's just going to make cattle breeding so much easier. But I think we're hearing again and again and again that's not the case. So we need to be just embracing uncertainty. Somebody said that earlier today. You know, and we embrace uncertainty. Uncertainty is the tool of the cattle breeder. It always has been. I think it's going to continue to be. And the successful breeders are going to be those that can manage that uncertainty most effectively. And that's the way it's always been before. But, you know, if we can eliminate these subclinical defects, or maybe not, eliminate is probably not the best term, if we can reduce their frequency substantially, and if we can do that across a lot of them, a large number of them throughout the industry, this may be our best chance at reducing variation in commercial cattle production. And it's not just reducing variation, it's getting rid of the variation that's caused by those that are at the very bottom, which are the ones that we really want to get rid of, the ones that create the nonconformities that really impose a lot of cost on the cattle industry. So whether it'll work or not remains to be seen, but let's consider it. So what are the costs of doing it? The cost of the breeder are basically fall into two categories. There's the cost of the DNA testing and analysis services, and it's not just running a DNA test and getting the genotypes back. You know, this whole process has to be pretty interactive with a partner in the DNA testing business. And somebody's got to provide some real analysis to get these things pinpointed down to those regions of the genome that contain the defect. And if we're talking about maybe identifying these across different generations, that means you're going to be refining the location of the gene as we go through time. So it's really a service rather than a product. And then the breeder has some cost in breeding the daughters of the sire back to the old sire. It's an opportunity cost. Certainly, if you do that and the bull has one or more defects, then you're going to have a cost associated with those affected progeny. They're probably not going to be worth, they'd be worth market price at the very best scenario, and perhaps nothing in the worst scenario. So that's a cost to the breeder of doing it. But, you know, what could be a bigger cost is the loss of potential value of the unaffecteds just due to the fact that you have to market these animals and they're inbred animals. And, you know, I don't know. I don't have experience trying to market animals like that, but I suspect that in today's environment there could be some challenges in getting that done. So I want to take you through. I realize perception is probably 90% of it in marketing, and reality is maybe the other 10%. But let's think about what some of the reality is in it. Are inbred animals worth more or less than non-inbred animals? from similar families. And what I mean here, I want to compare if the average genetic merit was the same, and they're either inbred or outbred. Okay, so their EPDs should be the same, their breeding values for quantitative traits should be the same, but they're either inbred or they're outbred. Are the inbred animals that are not affected, not visibly identifiable as being carriers or being affected by a genetic defect, so are they more or less likely to carry the genetic defect? And I'll bet that if we went out and polled seed stock producers or commercial producers just out all across the country, not the folks that are here in this room today, 90%+ of them would say the inbreds are more likely to carry the genetic defect. That'd be my guess. Inbreeding just has a bad rap for being associated with defects. But, in reality, they're less likely to have a genetic defect because the allele frequency going into this population under the assumptions I gave you is identical. But in the inbreds, we already took out the ones that had two copies of the defect. And so the ones that remain actually have a lower probability of carrying a defect. I think that's something important for us to remember as we're managing genetic defects and thinking about marketing cattle that are inbred. Now, so are the affected inbred animals going to be more or less likely to have extremely high genetic merit? I'll bet again, if we go out and poll breeders, they'll say, oh, they're less likely to have extremely high genetic merit. But animal breeding theory tells us that the variance of inbred progeny of a sire is going to be greater than the variance of outbred progeny. And the consequence of that is the good progeny will be better, the bad progeny will be worse. Now, you all can figure out what's the value difference between your culls getting a little worse or your best bull getting a little better. The total return should be higher from the inbred progeny. That doesn't mean there aren't marketing challenges in getting this across to your customer. But just consider that there is a real basis for why there could be value in applying this kind of a program in addition to uncovering the recessive defects. You're actually creating genetic variation, and genetic variation is the basis upon which genetic improvement occurs. So there are some benefits there. So whether those inbred progeny are worth less or more, I think really depends on how effectively you can market them. And I think there's real opportunities for the really skillful marketers to take advantage of it. But obviously it's not a trivial issue to deal with. I've made the point a couple times. I think for it to really be beneficial, it needs to just kind of become standard operating procedure. This is what's expected of a bull that's going to become really highly influential in his breed. And perhaps go even beyond that level. I think if we can get it demonstrated and implemented, I think the marketing challenges eventually go away, and then that makes it a lot easier to cover the other costs to reap the benefits of it. So if eventually most sires that were influential had been through this progeny or through this process, and the young sire that you're testing, let's say that his sire and his maternal grandsire have already been through the process, you may know that he's got two of these things that you want to get rid of, but you know where they are and you can manage them. But the risk of finding something new in a bull that's like that, where his sire's been through it and his maternal grandsire's been through it, is a whole lot less than the risk of starting out with a bullet you really don't know anything about from the perspective of recessive defects. So it's going to decrease the number of defects, the new ones that you're going to find. It's going to make the mapping of those a whole lot more efficient because every one of these animals that you put through it is going to be related to a number of unaffected from previous generations, possibly affected as well, but at least related to unaffected. Eventually, I think we could get by with producing a smaller number of daughters than what we need in the early stages of it in order to have the same efficiency of mapping. Or, alternatively, we keep the number of daughters the same and the magnitude of the deleterious effect that we can detect and manage just gets progressively smaller as we go through time. So we start out getting rid of the really big things that are really obvious, and as we go through time, we get more and more power to find progressively smaller and smaller effects, which is not unlike a lot of the other things we've discussed happening in the realm of DNA testing. So I told you I wanted to challenge your paradigms in thinking about recessive defects. In order for this to work, we can't label carriers of recessive defects as animals that are unusable, unmarketable. We just have to accept that recessive defects are part of livestock breeding, and we just apply slow selection to them and we get rid of them over time. Or at least, I shouldn't say get rid of or eliminate. We reduce their frequency to the point that they're not economically important anymore. And as they become unimportant, you put less pressure on them. If they're at really high frequency, you find something that's in a bull that's really influential in the breed. He's got a lot of relatives out in the breed. It's pretty important to put some pressure on it. But when you find something that has occurred in just a sire that's had some influence, but he's not really distributed throughout the whole industry, you just get rid of it as you can, and you work it into it becomes one more factor that you consider in your breeding program. So I think there's a myth out there that genetic defects just kind of replicate and increase in frequency like viruses. If you're not actively selecting against them, they're absolutely have to increase in frequency. There's no other way. That's really not true. There may be a few of them where the carriers have some side effect that puts a little upward pressure on them, but it's usually not very strong. And most of them probably have no effect as carriers, and they're as likely to go down as they are to go up in frequency. But if we can just put mild pressure on reducing these things and put that pressure, spread that pressure across a large number of these things, we'll have a lot more effect on the industry than if we try to get rid of every one of them as fast as we possibly can. I think that the real cost of recessive defects is an emotional thing. It's people get passionate about it, and it's the imagined scenario that it's going to actually destroy an entire breed or something like that. That causes people to overreact to recessive defects. And what the actual cost at the commercial production level is of any of these defects is just inconsequential relative to the loss that seed stock producers incur from having animals declared of no value just because they carry a defect. And I think we have to move beyond that mindset. It's just an unreasonable burden for the industry to bear. It'll be hard to do to make that transition, but I think it's really an unnecessary cost that we deal with. And then we need to remember we can use mating systems. Once we have these things mapped, we can avoid mating carriers to carriers and the affecteds go away. I mean, that can happen right away. You don't have to eliminate the gene from the population in one generation to pretty well eliminate the occurrence of affected animals. And so we really need to think about that. That's an opportunity I think we haven't fully utilized. And so the question is, do you want to be reactive or proactive? I think the current approach of putting out fires is a reactive approach. What I'm proposing is a proactive approach. It comes at some cost, especially initially, to get the infrastructure set up to do it. I think there's a lot of potential benefit to the industry from doing it. I'll be really interested to hear what you all think. I'm sure there's a lot of problems with it. But to wrap up, I think that we could use a system like this to select against recessive defects. I think it's probably feasible to do. I think it's possible that it could improve uniformity, and we don't have very many tools for improving uniformity. The extent to which we could do that is unknown. It would require, from my perspective, a totally new class of DNA testing services that's not commercially available. I view that as a pretty good opportunity for the companies that are in the DNA testing business, and I hope they'll think hard about it. It's an application of DNA testing that several of us have been thinking about for a number of years, but it really has been unexploited. It just seemed like it was time to throw it out and get people thinking about it. So I appreciate your attention. Sorry we ran late and cutting into your break.